Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com or download the Whole Foods Market app to learn more and find the store nearest to you.
Hey, thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. This is Katie, HRN Executive Director, and I'm so excited to share with you our coverage from the Charleston Wine and Food Festival.
We are here live today at Charleston Wine and Food.
Join us as we talk all things food.
Come to Charleston, eat some seafood. Eat all of the seafood.
Chicken fried chicken with chorizo steak and salsa verde mashed potatoes.
So quintessentially like Southern fare at its finest.
And have important conversations.
We're also talking about professional women in restaurants and how underrepresented they are, people of color in restaurants, and how they're not talked about.
We get real with Food Network's Manit Chauhan.
Balance is BS. I was told that I wasn't going to be bleeped out.
And find out about raising sugarcane with Chef Sean Brock.
It's like being Indiana Jones or something. You never know what you're going to find.
You'll come away inspired by the power of food and the food scene in Charleston. Here's Dr. Jessica B. Harris.
Food is constantly in flux. Food is always moving. Food is the only real lingua franca that we have that allows us to connect with other folks.
So tune in to Heritage Radio Network on tour at heritageradionetwork.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can't go wrong.
Hello, this is your host, Dana Cowan, and you are listening to Speaking Broadly on Heritage Radio Network. Each week, I interview someone who is working behind the scenes in the food world. Today, my guest is not only working behind the scenes in the food world, but she's working in the world of the unseen and the invisible. If you want to know about the force that connects life and death, that connects all humans who touch, you'll want to listen as I talk to Eugenia Bone. Eugenia has just published a book called Microbia, A Journey into the Unseen World Around You. It's about microbes. Yes, it's in the news, of course, because people are focusing on gut health. But as Gina can tell you, there is so, so much more. Gina's a prolific writer. I first met her when she was doing recipes for Food & Wine magazine. I think even before your first book, The Mesa's Edge. And I got to know her first through her father in a story that we did with Ed Giobbe, her dad, and Jacques Pepin. And as time has gone on, I've watched Gina focus from the really large world of recipes down to the smaller world of mushrooms, which is her last book, and now down to this invisible scale, which is microbes. So, Gina, welcome.
Thank you. So happy
to have you.
Thank you, Dana.
So, in some ways, I feel like you've been heading towards this book your entire life.
Me too.
Because you've always seen the interconnection of things, the interconnection of the seasons and what we eat and how we live. And now you've come down to the most, like the smallest, most elemental part of life. When I think about that great time that we spent with your father and walking around the land and, you know, seeing where the sausage was hanging and seeing the wine and seeing it all come together in the kitchen, and then thinking about what you're doing today, it just seems like there's a through line. Is this an imaginary connection that I'm making, or is it there somehow?
No, it's absolutely there. Ultimately, I think that I'm interested in how one thing leads to another. And that's really evident in food and in my kind of fascination with how you can use waste streams of foods that you make to make other foods. So the interconnectedness of the kitchen is just a reflection of those same ideas. But then, you know, the smaller you get into looking at the connections of things, like the connections between different microbial organisms, bacteria and fungi, in a way, the connections become more and more profound because they affect all things that live.
I love that because I've always thought food was pretty profound because that creates connections between people.
Yes.
But in fact, you have found more profundity in the smaller elements. Tell me about that.
Well, right now, let's talk about connections for a minute. Right now, you and I are going to spend some time together in this room, and we're both shedding bacteria from our scalps and our skin and our various orifices, bacteria and yeast cells and dead skin cells. And we all go through life in this cloud of microbial debris.
And so we're all like pig pen?
Yes, exactly.
We're microbial pig pens.
Yes, but the more time you and I spend together, the more homogenized our two unique clouds. I mean, of course, there's a lot of similar microbes because we're the same species. But over time, the longer throughout the course of this hour, our microbial clouds will homogenize and we are going to become more and more connected as a result. Like we're like two Venn diagram. We're like a Venn diagram of Dana and Gina. And in the center is our microbial homogenized cloud.
Okay, that's weird. And so what happens to our homogenized cloud, the Gindana?
So this thing that's happening right now of our, you know, shedding our skin microbes will settle to the floor after we leave. And when the good folks here at Roberta's walk through, or Heritage Radio walk through, they'll just kick us up. and eventually, you know, they'll disperse and so on. But that is, I mean, it's really another way of defining friendship or family. Because with your children, you're constantly in a state of homogenized microbes from kissing and from just being in each other's presence, from hugging, all that.
I love that notion because I think also with husbands and wives or people who live together, that homogenization happens and they become one, right? Like my microbes become more like whoever I'm living with.
Yeah, it's just like milk. You know, they get milk from one farm and milk from another farm, and homogenized, it becomes a single product. And that's true in spaces. It's true in the intimacy of families. It's true between lovers. It's true between friends and in communities.
So I'm just thinking of all, you know, all of the sloughed off cells I'm sharing with my friends all the time. It doesn't sound so appealing, all those cells sloughing off all the time. But I guess that it's just fine because they're very, very small. One of the things that we are reading about so much right now is, you know, the gut, right? And so the microbes in our guts and what we should do about them and how we should feed them and how we should take care of them and how they're going to take care of us. I need an update on that. Like, can you just cut through all of the microbial cloud clutter and tell me what I should be thinking about that?
There's a lot of material coming, you know, new research coming in all the time. I mean, if you're like me and you have like one of those Google flags on bacteria, it pretty much clogs your email daily. So the way the microbiology scene, especially regarding the gut microbiome, where there's a lot of work being going on, the way it's evolving is it's sort of like a gigantic jigsaw puzzle with lots of little pieces. And so each bit of information, each paper is like another piece in this puzzle. The whole, the image of the puzzle hasn't been completed, right? So so the science is evolving. That said, what I try to do in my book is to have some overall principles that you can apply or that make sense of this incomplete puzzle. So the thing that helped me the most in understanding my relationship with the microbes that live in my guts and on my skin and my scalp and so on is to think of it in terms of a very famous example from bio class that I learned when I went back to school. And that is the wolves in Yellowstone Park. So there used to be wolves in Yellowstone Park, and the wolves were preying on ranchers' sheep. So the ranchers complained, and the Parks Department got rid of the wolves. As a result, the deer population increased. They overgrazed the willows. They hung out in the stream banks. They beat up the stream banks. They ate all the willows. There was no willows for the beavers to build their dams. You know, it had these cascading effects. It just, you know, sort of tanked the ecology. And then the wolves were put back. They were reintroduced, and the ecology restabilized. The takeaway is it's not the deer that are the problem. It was the numbers of deer. It was deers without their natural predators. And so the same thing is going on in your gut. You have an ecology of organisms that over evolutionary time have reached a certain ecological stability. And when you take something like antibiotics and you wipe out the wolves or you wipe out the deer, you end up screwing with the stability of that ecology, and you get diarrhea or worse. So I find that a helpful way to think. You know, if you think about your body more as park management,
I'll try.
Yeah, it's useful, and when you read these papers or you read these headlines about the gut microbiome, you can start putting these puzzle pieces together and get a bigger picture.
I feel like a lot of the conversation though is, take prebiotics, take probiotics, eat fermented foods. You're very passionate about preserved foods,
right?
Fermented foods that comes from your life as a cook. Were you surprised when you put those things all together? Hey, I love fermented things. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
You know, now I'm studying the microbiome and they all work together.
Totally. Well, when I wrote about preserving, which I've done in a couple of my cookbooks, you know, that's all about killing microbes. Except in the case of fermentation. But if you can, your fermented product, if you can, your sauerkraut, then you're killing the microbes. You're making it quiet. You're making it still. There's no, you know, active ecology happening anymore. So that's, you know, preserving is how to take microbes out of the picture. You know, now I'm like interested in, okay, so what do those microbes do when they're in the picture, and why, and how are they actually beneficial versus, you know, in the case of a canned good, not so beneficial.
Right, because that could kill you maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be bad. Although then we're back to microbes, and, you know, some microbes can eat the whatever. There is life to death, right? Because you were talking about your fascination with death and microbes.
Yes. Yes. So, all right. So that's like a very cool subject when you think about, you know, we carry with us microbes that maintain our health, but then once we die and oxygen isn't coming in anymore and our immune systems are quiet or finished, you know, not active, then other populations of microbes that are present increase, and so they are our undoing. In fact, microbes like bacteria and their sister microbe, archaea, these are like really simple organisms. They don't even have a nucleus in their cell. They bridge the living and non-living worlds. They take nutrients out of the atmosphere and from minerals, and they terrestrialize them and make it available to the rest of the food chain. And then they disassemble and return those nutrients back into the pool of opportunity. So they are, they are performing this. To me, it's almost like a spiritual type of role.
It's sort of God's work, if you believe in that.
Yeah. Well, you can call it God's work. That's fine with me.
As opposed to God being in the details, God is in the microbes.
Yeah, which are very small, like details, weren't they?
Okay, but I do want to go back to this small obsession I have, because I want to know, am I supposed to take probiotics? Am I supposed to take prebiotics?
Right.
Help me out there.
Okay.
What's the answer?
So what are probiotics? Probiotics are live bacteria.
Am I supposed to believe that there's really billions of live bacteria when I take a spoon of something?
Well, yeah, the problem with supplements and commercial probiotic products is what probiotics are in there, what is their live count, you know, what was the growing process, what was the manufacturing process, the shipping, all of these all of these elements can affect the viability of that of those bacterial colonies. And then, are they the ones you need? Are they the ones you need in the numbers that you need them? That's all kind of a crapshoot. You're not. You may hurt yourself if you take too many probiotics because you'll be messing around with that ecological balance.
The parkland.
The park, right. But, just as likely or more likely, you're probably just spending your money for nothing. If you really want to get some good probiotics, make your own sauerkraut, make your own yogurt, and have that as a regular part of your meal, because probiotics are, you know, we're talking about transient, in many ways, in many cases, transient microbes. They're coming in, they're doing some good work, and then they're coming out the other end. So you have to keep this supply. So it's really most effective if you're going to, from what I've read so far, it's most effective to use probiotics as a part of, let's just say, fermented foods that are heavy in this lactobacillus that produces, you know, some good stuff for your body, to constantly be eating fermented foods as part of your diet. Prebiotics is bacteria food.
Right? Uh-huh.
So, and there's an array of bacterial species, genus, genera and species that live in your guts that are fiber fermenters. They need fiber. They're byproducts of them eating your fiber, the fiber that you eat, they use, and their byproducts are compounds that are necessary to build really important stuff like hormones and neurotransmitters. You need them to be happily fed and in adequate numbers in order to, you know, have serotonin in your body.
That seems really basic.
Which is, you know, it's really fundamental. So they're like the big farm of your body. Those fiber fermenters, those the ones you feed with prebiotics mainly in your colon. The thing is if you take a prebiotic supplement? That's just so weird. I mean, an apple is a prebiotic.
And right. And why is that? Because it feeds the fiber. It's
yeah.
a fiber feeder.
I mean, we don't have the enzymes. Our genes don't make the enzymes to break down cellulose. No animal does. All animals have bacteria in their guts that break down that cellulose. We don't use the cellulose. They use the cellulose, but their byproducts help us build important compounds that we need to be healthy.
That means we were left sort of incomplete when we were finished, right? Because having the prebiotics, you need to get them from someplace else.
Well, that's if you think of evolution as a linear thing where, you know, we've evolved away from bacteria. But the truth is, we've evolved with these bacteria all along.
Okay. I just have to ask you, when we met, you know, you were, like a happy, healthy hippie, right? I think that's fair to say. A spectacular cook. You had a divine couple of kids, husband, and you were just, cooking was such a passion, and it's something that, I don't want to say it was your profession, but it's, you professionalized it. It seems like there's such a distance between that and speaking almost like, you know, a biology professor, but a very comprehensible, entertaining one at that. How did that happen? Like, what was the evolution inside Gina that went from the one to this really deep place of studying and understanding these elements of nature?
So my path, whether it's makes sense or not, I don't know, but I started, I was interested in food because I like to eat food, and I had grown up, I was lucky enough to grow up in a food forward atmosphere, so I had a good palate, and I wanted to eat food that tasted really good, and I was and I knew how to shop for food, for vegetables and so on. So I got into cooking because I was feeding myself. It was personally, totally for my own joy. And then I got into mushrooms because they were so curious. They weren't a meat and they weren't a vegetable. There was something in between. And I was interested in that phenomena because I didn't really understand what fungi were early in, you know, whatever, 15 years ago. And then at the same time, I had bought a cabin in Colorado with my husband in the West Elks where we have our place. There's in the fall, there's these fantastic fruitings of Boletus, or the porcini, the mushrooms in the porcini group, chanterelles, all kinds of beautiful edibles. And I lusted after them, again, food thing, and I wanted them. But in order to find wild mushrooms without, you know, taking out your family, I had to learn a little bit about why they grew, why they lived where they did. And that led me into a study of mycology, the study of fungi and mushrooms, the fruiting body of mushrooms, and the fruiting body of fungi is mushrooms. Actually of only a small percentage of fungi. Most fungi don't produce mushrooms. There's somewhere between 1.5 and 5 million species, and there's only about 30,000 that produce mushrooms. And we only eat about 34 of those, and about 12 of them will, like, take out your liver. So I got really...
sort of stunning numbers.
Yeah, it's surprising, right? There's so many species. And I got really sort of fell in love with the biology of fungi and the role of fungi in providing nutritional services to plants. So this is, you know, you hear more and more about mycorrhizal fungi or mycelium. Mm-hmm. So the fungi that lives on in the roots of plants, that fungi forages for nutrients in the soil and delivers those nutrients to plants in exchange for sugars that the plants make from photosynthesis. But then I found out that between the cells of all plants, there was fungi too. Huh. I was like, well, what the hell is it doing there? I mean, why isn't the plant rejecting this thing crawling between its cells? Well, it turns out that that kind of fungi provides immune services to the plant.
Wow.
It keeps, sometimes the, like, here's a good example of what endophytic, that means inside plant, fungi do. Fescue grass is commonly used for golf courses. But if your pony eats the fescue grass, it'll give it a kind of gangrene that'll cripple it. It's not the grass that's making the pony sick. It's the fungus living between the cells of the grass that makes the pony sick. So the fungus provides a service that wards off herbivores or predators to the grass. And in exchange, it gets sugars from the plant. So that's one of many relationships between fungus and plants. So then I started hearing about the gut microbiome, you know, reading the newspaper headlines, and I was saying, wow, it looks like bacteria do the same thing in us, provide immune functions and forage nutrients from the environment on our behalf, that bacteria do the same thing for us that fungi do for plants. And I was like, well, there's obviously a pattern here. And then I got really excited because grand universal patterns in nature are the thing that really lift me into a sort of spiritual type of realm.
And so is that the state that I find you in now? I mean, finding spirituality in this connected universe.
Yeah, I do. Recognize or learning a little bit about how that our seen world is supported in this really profound way, like in terms of our ability to just survive, by an unseen life force, this matrix of microbes, to me is the equivalent of what people are looking for when they study the different faiths. It's just that it's a scientific answer, which works for me.
Okay, with that, we're going to take a quick break and we're going to jump from the scientific to the personal when we come back in just a minute. So stay with us.
Well, she's her own. She's her own female. She's her own female. That's why I like her. I like her a lot. And she don't know that she's her own female. She's her own female, and she don't know. That's why I like her a lot.
Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. From papayas and samosas to reishi mushrooms, if it's something that sounds delicious, chances are you'll find the freshest, best version of it at Whole Foods Market. They have more than 400 stores across the country, so if you consider pizza its own food group or just can't imagine when avocado toast wasn't a thing, Whole Foods Market has you covered. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com to find a store near you. Whole Foods Market. Whatever makes you whole.
Welcome back to Speaking Broadly. This is your host, Dana Cowan, and it is my deep pleasure to have Gina Bone with me today on the occasion of the publication of her book, Microbia. So I'm hoping you heard the first part where we're talking about spirituality and the microbiome. That's not exactly where I expected the conversation to go today, but I'm so happy that it has because seeing the connectedness in the universe is a very, you know, profound way to spend a Monday. So, Gina, I want to just talk about your curiosity, because when I hear the story of how you went from just loving and lusting after food to your curiosity about, you know, mushrooms and what are they, that then led you down quite a deep journey into understanding the world of fungi. And that indeed led you to this journey today. Just talk about curiosity and how curiosity drives you as a human.
It's a search for answers, you know, but mostly I think that my curiosity is driven by intuitive feeling. So I have an intuitive feeling that something is true, but because of my own self-doubts, I don't just go and I don't wing it based on my intuition, and I look for verification elsewhere. And indeed, when I got started to get interested in microbiology, I tried to self-teach. I tried to read papers and understand anything. I mean, what the hell is a transmembrane protein? I mean, it was just so confusing. So then I tried online course, bio, the first sort of online course that came up when you put bio 101 into the Google. And that was really difficult in a way, too, because I would forget I would forget things I had taught. There wasn't lesson before, and so then I'd have to drop into stuff like Khan Academy and Google to try to remember what is the Krebs cycle. And I just was digging these deeper and deeper holes for myself. So finally, I kind of came to the realization that if I was going to verify my intuitions that we're all connected. And, you know, I had already sort of gotten there with food, and I'd already sort of figured it out a little bit with fungi. But then the bacteria thing, that was a little heavy for me. So I went back to college. And going back to college, I'll tell you, humility is the entry point to studying science. For me, I mean, I was an English major, you know, and I hadn't been back to school. I mean, I just have a bachelor's degree in poetry.
So wow. You didn't have any fear of the science, because you'd tried it on your own, right? And if it had been me, I'm like, okay, I didn't understand Khan Academy. I didn't understand any of these papers. I'm not sure it's going to get that much better with a teacher at the front of the room. And that probably would have shut me down right there. But was it confidence that just with enough perseverance, you would conquer the science, or your interest was just that deep?
You know, there's a certain... I do not have the gene for science and math, but I do have a kind of stubborn gene. If there is such a one, I think I've got it because I just wasn't going to be daunted. And so going back to school was like my last chance of getting somewhere with this material. And it was hugely challenging. I mean, I was the age of the other students' mothers, for sure. You know, I'm at that stage of life where I never remember where I parked the car. I'm walking around with my glasses on my head looking for them. You know, those sort of typical things. All of which are not a sign of Alzheimer's. I mean, it's only a real problem if you forget that you drove your car to the store in the
That's
first
really
place.
Good to know, because I also show signs of, like, you know, where did I leave my wallet? Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. The memory. And I was worried about memorizing. I was really worried about tests. I mean, the truth is that I think that during the course of our lives, we gravitate toward things we're good at. For me, that was reading and writing, metaphors, interpretive stuff like that, and cooking. But cooking has got more science in it than a lot of people think. You know, it's when you're developing a recipe, you have to be very, very specific, and you have to double check stuff, and you're weighing it in different ways, and weighing product, you know, in different ways. So it wasn't that alien. It was just one wouldn't think that coming from developing panna cotta recipes and studying microbiology, we're actually utilizing some of the same thinking skills. It's ultimately precise thinking, and then when it comes to writing, evocative language.
Mm. Right. Well, I think that's why your book is so delightful to read, because you understand the science, and then you're like a microdigester or whatever those things are called.
right. Where you? I'm a decomposer.
A decomposer because, you know, when I read it, I'm like, oh, I get this, and
I
don't have that blinded feeling that you say about like the Krebs cycle, and I'm like, I know I read about that somewhere. But because your use of metaphor is so vivid, and then your ability to, you know, break things down and explain them is so good, the book is just such a great read.
Oh,
and
thanks.
I connect perhaps a bit less to the science than your journey going from, a non-student, really, really successful in the world, to trying something completely new. I mean, did you feel like that was a little crazy?
Well,
it was
my
quite
husband
a bit of time,
did.
Right? I mean,
yeah,
it
was years
like,
and years.
It's not like it was, you know, you're taking a course one semester.
You know, I mean, the actual time I was in Columbia was just 1 year. But I spent many years trying to figure it out beforehand. And then a couple of years after, then utilizing my knowledge. So I was able to read the scientific papers to a degree. I mean, not really weedy, weedy stuff, but enough to like navigate my way.
College.
Oh,
what was it like to go back? I mean, you were as old as these people's mothers. Has school changed?
Yes, it has. I mean, my day, it was like blackboards and Xerox handouts. You know, now it's all digital. I'll never forget I went into a chemistry class, and there was this, I was very nervous. It was the first class, and there was this beautiful girl sitting next to me in teeny tiny hot pants. And she had this long blonde hair, and she kept flipping her hair, and it was splashing across my shoulder during the course of the class. Well, the teacher had us, the teacher had all these slides up about signing up for recitation. I didn't even know what recitation was. I was like really hoping somebody would ask in this classroom of 200, you know, 19 to 22-year-olds. And at the same time, and then right after that, he launches into this lecture about electron orbitals and all this. Really, I had no background in it. I was very confused. But I was thinking, wow, there's this beautiful girl next to me, and she's going to have a social life. And if she can do this, then I can do it. And so I'm struggling, taking notes. And I look over to her at one point, and with her left hand, she has her computer open, and she's signing in for recitation, which is the study groups that you have to attend. And with her right hand, she's making notes from the lecture. And I thought, well, I'm screwed.
How did you overcome that? Like, just study harder, or what was it?
I did. I studied. I just really, you know, bit the bullet and worked really hard. And I asked a lot of questions. And I did it in some cases. Found myself completely out of my league, like genetic probabilities. I just couldn't get. It was like trying to reach something on a shelf that was just too short to reach. And that was very frustrating. But, you know, I just kind of muddled through the stuff that was so far out of my orbit concentrated, put most of my energy into the things that I was able to grasp. And I studied really hard, and I didn't do that well on the tests.
God, that must have been so hard.
It was horrible.
You know, like, you're probably used to getting those great grades. I mean, poetry, probably great grades.
Well, the thing is, you know, I've spent my life doing stuff that I have a natural inclination for, and Here I was dumping a whole bunch of time and money. It's not cheap to go back to school. It was much cheaper back in my day, into studying this stuff, and... It was a lesson, as I said before. It was like a real lesson in humility to overcome my own, to learn the science. But it was a little prideful too, to overcome my own fears of not being a science person, you know.
And so how did you do that? Was that just perseverance too? Because I think there's many people who are listening who probably feel that, you know, the nagging feeling like, I don't know how to do that. I'm not even going to try. And I feel like there's a counterbalance to that, which is, you know, what's the worst thing you could do is fail. I mean, and that's how terrible is that? That's not so bad.
But also it's, you know, I think that we think that, that you can't learn some things, that you're just programmed not to learn some things. And that's just not true.
Yeah.
That's a fallacy. You can learn whatever you want to learn. It's just really a matter of persistence.
Okay, so you know, I'll think hard about that. There's definitely some things that I'm not so sure that I can learn, but it might be just you know, some block in desire. I want to talk about your amazing family, because you know, I've known you as your kids have grown up, and then your kids, you know, left the house. Another thing that you know, turned out to be daunting. So one might imagine you have this really full life filled with fungi and microbes and cooking and friends and really robust life. And yet when you're, you know, when your kids were gone, it sounds like you were surprised by how strong your reaction was to that.
Yeah. When I first left, you know, I was excited and nervous and proud and, you know, and a little sad to have her go. But it's when the second left that and went away to college that I had that the classic empty nest experience. What it really was about for me was realizing a stage of my life was over, and so ultimately it's a kind of awakening to mortality. And that also happens when folks' parents die. They'll tell you the same thing. You kind of wake to the notion of mortality in a really personal way. And so when your kids are all flowing, you know, when there's nobody else, when it's gone, that's over. And then nostalgia becomes this part of one's life. It didn't for me. And I realized, oh, that feeling of, you know, your kid grabbing your hand to walk across the street.
One of the best feelings ever.
Gone. Yeah. Or the tears that you're able to soothe. That's gone. As adults, you can't do that for them so much.
Sorry. And then, of course, your parents were getting older at the same time, and you're so close to your father. I was also very close to my father. I spent every Saturday with him. We went to antique shops. It was sort of the happiest family time that I spent was being with him on Saturdays. And you and your dad have an extraordinary routine. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. So after my son went away to college, I was like very mopey and was crying and stuff. So I called my dad, and I said, you know, Dad, I'm really sad that Mo has gone away, and now my kids are gone. And he said, well, you need to get involved in another project. And he said, why don't we do a book together on recipes for baby foods, you know, to help young mothers do good cooking for their children. And I was like, no, I'm over. I mean, the kid thing is done. I said, I'm interested in the next stage. How do you cook in deep old age? How are you managing to cook for your increasing age? Because he cooks two meals a day for himself. He gardens. He's really a man of the earth. He makes his own wine, all that stuff that you saw those years ago. Still going strong on it. So he said, all right, I'll meet you. And we made an agreement where every Friday morning we meet on Arthur Avenue at Tino's Delicatessen, 9 a.m. Anybody wants to come by. We meet at 9 a.m.
I'm coming. I'm really. Your dad's amazing. You're amazing. And I bet Tino's Delicatessen is spectacular. What's your standing order?
Oh, well, we just have coffees to start
just
there.
Just coffees, okay.
And then we do a little shopping there. And then I follow Ed on his path, which is the same. He's a man of habits. So it's the same path. He hits the same stores in a row. He has a little, like, chatting up, telling some jokes, speaking a little Italian to all the different vendors that he visits. And during the course of that shopping morning, it takes a few hours, he gives me the recipes, and I write down all the recipes that he's made during the week.
And does he, as a man of habit, does he do different recipes every week? How is that possible?
Oh, yeah, because it's evolving. He's not, like, looking at recipes and books and shopping for them. He's going into the market. He's seeing what looks good, and he's responding to the seasons and what's there. And he's his cooking style, he's Central Italian of origin. And so the cooking style has, like a lot of the Abruzzese chefs, it's not so much about the mentality is to do these very savory combinations with few ingredients and some unusual cooking techniques. So that's what he applies. Well, like a potaccio, for example. So that would be cooking a protein with wine, savories like garlic and herbs until it's really quite dry. It's like a very, very dry braise. And then often a vegetable will be added toward the end, like broccoli di rape or Swiss chard or even potatoes, something like that.
That sounds remarkable.
It's just super, super simple and very savory. Hmm. I mean, like lots of flavor. And then you can sex it up with capers or olives and, you know, things like that. So I got really interested in how he's in robust health. I mean, he's just tough as a baseball mitt.
And at 91.
At 91. And I got really interested in how he was feeding himself and maintaining his health. He was really responding to his body. So he wasn't looking outside of himself for answers to what made him feel good. So, for example, he doesn't eat pasta at night, and he doesn't eat raw vegetables at night. It's harder to digest. You know, his body is too active, so he doesn't sleep as well. So I have all of these soup recipes and egg recipes that he has at night now. Makes it easier for him to sleep. And then also some turkey stuff, because, you know, turkey helps you fall asleep.
Oh, because it has tryptophan.
Yeah, so yeah. He's doing stuff like that, but he's not doing it because he read about it in a magazine. He's doing it because he's listening to his body. And then for lunch, he eats more robust. He only drinks during lunch, although I noticed I think he's taking a little snort of brandy in the morning just to, like, get up. But, you know, in general, he's he just is focusing the most heavy stuff, bread and so on, during the day. And so I've been tracking these recipes, and even though they're, you know, they're not old people food. Mm-hmm. They're just age responsive foods. So one of the things that I love that I noticed he was making is that he would bake a potato, And that, like an Idaho potato, and then put a little olive oil and salt and pepper on it, and then he'd poach an egg. And he'd put that on top with a little olive oil and some parsley. And it was just so elegant.
So elegant, and actually so of the moment. Really not why he did it, but I bet there's some...
It really, is of the moment?
Well, sure, there's probably great yolk porn, you know, you put the knife in and the yolk goes, yeah. And it makes that potato so delicious, and a little green for color, and... Anyway, clearly not what he has in mind, but in the age of Instagram, that's all I can think of. That'd be so great to see.
I'll tell you, Dana, when I started working on this micro book, Edward, I call my dad Edward because at his age, you know, I have to call him by his full name. He was really hot for getting a one of these stool analyses. Because he was quite sure, you know, you can find out what microbes are present in your guts. He was quite sure that he was going to have this. I mean, he treated it like he was going to, like it was a test he knew he was going to ace. Yeah. He thought for sure his microbes were going to be
better than everybody else's.
Oh, yeah. They were going to show like some incredible diversity and all of these fiber ferment. So we did the test. I mean, he was really bragged about his. Poops on a regular basis. And he, in fact, he even offered to give me some of his to sell for fecal transplants on the internet. He said to subsidize my writing income. Thanks, Ed. So we did the test and sent it in to a company called Ubiota. And what came back really kind of pissed Ed off because. It was the microbial, the phyla in his guts were dominated by bacteria that that break down carbohydrates and bacteria that break down fats, proteins and fats. And he
was... Is that pretty ordinary?
That's ordinary for a Western industrialized diet.
Yeah.
He eats tons of vegetables, right? And he grows his own vegetables. And to be honest with you, he doesn't even wash them very well, so he's getting all kinds of good soil microbes at the same time. But no, his microbiota was much the same as, like, the Prime Minister of France.
Well, that sounds actually pretty good. I think we could, you know, he could go around bragging about that. Probably. Okay, so I have, I'm going to have so many more questions for you, but I have one last one for the show. You know, I imagine in setting out to do this work, was there anyone who you looked to and you thought, like, what they're doing is really interesting and you're really inspiring me? Either someone you came across at Columbia or a great great inspiration somewhere along the way?
Well, there's a lot of people that I admire, for sure.
And hopefully a woman.
Yeah. Well, there's a department. The department that I was in at Columbia was ecology, evolution, and environmental biology. And the beauty of what those scientists, men and women, are working on is they're not just looking at how taking the chickadees out of a grassland's ecology can affect the charismatic organisms like the insects and the grass and the worms.
I love that's called a charismatic organism.
Oh, it's like if you can see it, it's pretty charismatic.
It's pretty charismatic.
In my book. Yeah. But they're also looking at further down the scale how the loss of a chickadee or the decline in chickadee populations could affect photosynthesizers, nitrogen fixers, those bacteria that are involved in these big chemical systems of the planet. The takeaway, I mean, what is so beautiful about the work they do is that they're trying to show how something as to us kind of insignificant as a decline in a little songbird population could end up affecting the arrangement of gases in the atmosphere.
Holy cow. I'd love to like end with a name, someone whose spirit we want to honor here. So is there a professor or it could be a cook, anyone you'd like to
I have to reach back to Edward Joby, my dad, he excited that interest in me into how one thing leads to another. I mean, I came from him. That's the analogy from parent to child to grandchild, from soil to plant to gut microbiome. It's, in a way, the same beautiful chain of events told, the same story told over and over.
And with that, everybody, that is the conclusion of this week's Speaking Broadly. Gina, how can people find you and tell them where to find your book, obviously on Amazon, but the full title and where to follow you on social?
So the full title of the book is Microbia, A Journey into the Unseen World Around You. It's in bookstores everywhere. It just came out. And, you know, all the online booksellers. And then I am at eugeniabone.com. So if you want to ask me something about your bacterioides, then
your bacterial
firmicutes or whatever. I mean, if I can't answer the question, I can direct you to where you might want to go to look for your answer.
That's great. And I'm Dana Cowan, as you know. You can find me at FW Scout on Instagram and on Twitter. Looking forward to hearing from you and looking forward to having you back next week. Have a great week. And until then, I want to thank my engineer, David Tatasciore, for another great show. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.